So I brought along a management leadership book called Good to Great, and this guy, Jim Collins, was already kind of well known, and this was his second hit book. But what he did for it was look at companies that had outperformed the market by 3 times. So he looked at American companies that had gone from good, you know, average performance, average returns for their shareholders, to great in terms of 3 times the return for their shareholders. And so some companies didn't make the cut, like Coca-Cola wasn't good enough, didn't make it in there, but others did. And they just then tried to analyse the data to see what made the difference, or to research these companies to see what made the difference. And he was a management guy. He'd written Built to Last about companies and organisations, and culture was kind of in vogue at the time. So they were surprised to see that it was leadership that made the difference to these companies to make them go from good to great. And in particular, the type of leadership really surprised them. So at the beginning of the book, he writes, "We were surprised, shocked really, to discover the type of leadership required for turning a good company into a great one." So that's our topic for today, the kind of leadership that is required for greatness, what makes a leader great. And I want us to notice from this passage that there is a way of the world that's the common way of practicing leadership, which is mentioned there in verse 42 of our passage. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." So the typical way of leading is to flex your muscles, to subdue people by an exercise of strength. I guess it's the idea that might is right. So an example of it was when Steve Jobs, he'd been exiled by his board from Apple, the company that he'd started. When he came back, one of the first things that he did was he got revenge and sacked the board and replaced it with new people. More common ways that we see is bosses can hold their juniors back, so not recommend them for promotions or not give them glowing references when the time comes. Or people that make things difficult, they can sideline, so by not assigning them their jobs with potential or the interesting jobs, they can easily sideline people. Or the old classic for taking the credit when things go well, it's all about what I've done. When things go badly, it's all about what they've done, and shift the blame in that way. But there's different kinds of leadership, very broadly speaking. 4 main tools in a leader's arsenal are ability. So often people will be good at some technical role before they're promoted to leadership. Authority, so they actually have the position where they can make the decisions. Persuasion, where you're trying to set a bigger picture, put things in its context, or encourage people towards a goal. And example, which you mentioned, Jan, are the 4 main styles of leadership, or the main things that a leader can do. The least effective of them is the authoritarian style of I've got the authority here, so you've got to do it. And when I think back to bad bosses that I've had in the past, every time they've issued a command, rather than using persuasion, it's worked in the short term, but then they've lost influence over me. And often in the past, they've then lost me as an employee as well. So I can remember a boss saying he had asked me to do something, and I had explained why I couldn't. And he said, "Okay, Paul, I'm not asking you, I'm telling you." And at that point, I started to devise my exit strategy from that organisation. But every time a bad boss uses their authority in that way, they diminish their ability to persuade. So in this passage, Jesus gives an alternative, which is what I want us to concentrate on today. It couldn't be any more different to the exercise of authority, but it is Jesus' alternative. He owns it, because historically we can trace it straight back to him. He spoke these words, which were even more countercultural at his time, but they're still countercultural today. So again, verses 42 to 43, 43 gives the alternative. "Not so with you. Instead, "Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." So, according to Jesus, the path to greatness is humility, which is what Dean mentioned before. Humility is the choice to lower yourself in order to lift someone else up. So it's not looking for the win-win, which isn't necessarily an exercise of humility because it doesn't involve the loss of the leader. It's looking for the lose-win, if you like, the loss of the leader in order to create a win for someone else. So one of the CEOs that they looked at here in Good to Great was Darwin Smith. So he was CEO of Kimberly-Clark, who isn't very well known. I guess it's kind of a humble brand, but it's everywhere. So it'll be in this building, it'll be in every house. It creates Kleenex and other home hygiene products. And he managed to outperform the market by 4 times, and not just for a few years, but for 20 years in a row, he outperformed the market by 4 times. So his quote, he used to be quite self-deprecating, and his philosophy of leadership was that he never stopped trying to become qualified for the job. So for 20 years, he strived to improve himself so that he could become better qualified to lead this already very successful company. So that was what they found, not just for Kimberly-Clark, but they found that consistently across these companies that made the leap from good to great. I'll read out the full quote about Jim Collins and this research that he did. "We were surprised, shocked really, to discover the type of leadership required for turning a good company into a great one. Compared to high-profile leaders with big personalities who made headlines and became celebrities, the good-to-great leaders seem to have come from Mars. Self-effacing, quiet, reserved, even shy, these leaders are a paradoxical blend of personal humility and professional will." So they found that it wasn't just personal humility, it was coupled with professional will. Like, they still were goal-orientated and determined in what they were doing. But what made them successful was, and what set them apart from other leaders, was that they combined it with humility, and that made all the difference. There was a, speaking of paradoxical, there was a general who led command forces in Afghanistan in the early days, so he was in charge of the air, land and sea support, and across not just the Americans, but he wasn't American, but a whole bunch of different countries all working together, and he said these words: "I found in my experience that the best answers and approaches may be counterintuitive. The opposite of what it seems you ought to do is what ought to be done. So when I'm asked the question, what approach should we take in Afghanistan, I say humility," which is countercultural for me. Like, might is right, surely that's got to be true in the army. But no, he was a very successful leader. One of the ways that he was successful was that he would encourage ground forces to be courageous and to exercise courageous restraint when it came to calling in air support. So if they were in a dangerous situation on the ground, the temptation was to just kind of withdraw and call in the air support and make the whole situation disappear. But he said, no, what you need to do is be courageous, risk your life and the life of the people that you're leading, in order to reduce civilian casualties, which is what then happened. There was a dramatic reduction in civilian casualties under General McChrystal, and even the Afghani president, who never praised the Americans, praised General McChrystal for his leadership. Closer to home, what might humility look like in practice? Well, I think humility will mean that leaders will listen to those who disagree with them, because the convenient thing for a leader to do is to listen to the yes men and women in their group and ignore those who are disagreeing, but to actually listen to the wisdom of people who disagree, or to foster the skills of your subordinates. So if you're a prime minister or head of a project, the best thing to do is to get rid of any threat and push them out into another team. But the risky thing to do is to foster the skills of those around you, knowing full well that they might take your job or take a promotion ahead of you as a result. I was inspired by a boss who worked on the Gorgon project. So he was in the, not in the main Chevron office, but the building next door, which was all contractors and high turnover, and just get the job done, you know, don't make things difficult in any way. And yet when people came to him and said inconvenient things like, I'd like to work part-time, he'd say, oh, okay, well, just tell me why and what you're after, and I'll go into bat for you. And he did, and it cost him a lot personally, but the result was in this team where there was huge turnover, like people were turning over every year. It would be amazing if you stayed in a role for a year back in 2009 and 2010. Everyone wanted to be in his team and nobody wanted to leave. And so he actually ended up having a very effective team and is still working as the head of that team in that role when the other half of the office has moved on. Humility works. It's counterintuitive, it is a virtue, and we've got Jesus to thank because it hasn't always been considered a virtue. In Jesus' day, it was even more countercultural. In fact, in your ancient lists of virtues, you would never find humility. You'd find determination there, but humility was regarded with suspicion or with contempt in the ancient world. But it was Easter, the moment when Jesus was humiliated by being executed by his enemies, that started to change. So the culture of the ancient world was based on honour and shame, as most cultures have been throughout history. And it was then as Jesus' followers grappled with the meaning of his death and became persuaded that his death, his humiliation, was actually an effective thing, that they started to reconsider that maybe honour and shame isn't the most important thing in the world. Maybe there's guilt and forgiveness that you could base a culture on. Jesus, in verse 45, taught that being humiliated would be for the benefit of other people. So verse 45 says, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." So it was a ransom in the sense that it was a price paid to set people free. And I guess it's the classic example of someone losing so that other people can win. And once Christians realized that, they started to practice humility in ways that the world had never seen before. They would lower themselves to take care of the sick, not just tending to their wounds, but even risking their lives through the plagues. And as people saw this, it was an attractive thing. It was the first time that it had been practiced, but people were attracted to it. Or they lowered themselves to care for the poor, because that wasn't really something convenient to do. They lowered themselves to care for the injured. And so the first hospitals that the world ever saw were the result of people not leaving soldiers to die on the battlefield, as would make sense, but people caring for wounded soldiers so that they might have a life afterwards. And for the first time, the world saw women and children and even enemies treated in new ways as Christians lowered themselves so that other people could be lifted up. So if you're in a position of authority, if you've been entrusted with that, then hopefully the lesson from Jesus is obvious here, that the way of the world might be to exercise your authority, but his way instead is to lower yourself in order to lift others up. But I think this idea of humility isn't just true for those who are in authority. If you haven't been given structural authority, you can still have a lot of influence on other people. You can still be a leader. And if leadership is inspiring other people to contribute to a goal, so inspiring people to head in a particular direction, then anyone in the team can do that. And I was really struck by a lady who shared with City Bible Forum last year with some of our young workers about how she'd been practicing humility. She wasn't the team leader. The team leader was spoken of badly, let's say, and wasn't highly regarded. Lots of people were leaving, and the reason why that they would give would be that leader. But PJ took it on herself to practice humility and to lead upwards as well as leading sidewards. A couple of things that she did was she started to celebrate other people's birthdays and special occasions. So she'd buy the cake and often pay out of her own pocket.
She had a little budget. They had a monthly meeting to all the birthdays.
Yep.
And the anniversaries had it on their bed at their office.
Mm. And she would then take a card around after a while for people to write down what they appreciated about the boss, which was a very difficult thing for most people to do. In fact, she got a lot of pushback on why you're doing this. And she was exercising really effective leadership at that point, not just doing it herself, but encouraging other people to praise someone, even if they didn't like everything about them. And has seen a good, healthy change in the culture of the organisation. More people have hung around, and people are certainly enjoying relationships in the office a lot more. It's gone from toxic to people, you know, working together.
So does that mean the boss changed?
No, the boss has changed. He's talked about more of his weaknesses and recognised that he doesn't have all the strengths.
He delegates a bit more. He was overloading himself and being a micromanager.
Mm.
Choosing to delegate to his middle managers and not control the weekly staff meeting. Don't use the staff meeting to get stuck into people. But yeah, the other managers have their do part of the meeting.
Yeah. So now people take it in turns to do meetings so it's tempting to think of greatness as how high I can rise, but true greatness, leaving a real legacy, making a real change in the world, comes from lifting other people up, often at your own expense. And I've got a favourite story from a Prime Minister just after World War II called Ben Chifley. So he had greatness thrust upon him in that his predecessor Curtin passed away in office and he was in the Labor Party and the ball got thrown to him. And he was a very quiet, humble guy. And when he would get a phone call at his office, there was, most phone calls would come through his staff, but he did have a number on his desk for his family or people who were close to him. But the thing was that that number was only one digit away from the local butcher's number. And so when the phone would ring and he'd pick it up and it'd be Mrs. Smith on the line, he would just say, "Oh, hi, Mrs. Smith, what are you after this week?" And he'd write down, even though he had 1,000 things to do, he'd write down her order and then call up the butcher and say, Mrs. Smith's order's come through and this is what it is. So humility is a beautiful thing, and I think it's not surprising that it's a key to greatness because it's the way Jesus practiced his humility. He wasn't a man who had any formal authority. He'd been, he was a homeless guy who depended on the charity of his supporters. He was rejected by the religious leaders at the time. But we're living in 2017. He's, changed the calendar in a big way and changed the world. So, Good to Great is a good book. And a Christian book on a similar theme, all about humility, is this one, Humilitas, which is a fancy, that's Latin for humility. So it's not a very humble way of saying humility, it's showing off. John Dixon has a good working knowledge of Latin, but it's a really good book on the history of humility and the difference that Jesus made to it.
Yep, thank you.